Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. Today we have Rip Rentz. We'll be talking about his poetry, his novels, and all the things that he does. And also I have my co-host, Richard Modiano, who will be starting the show.
Well, Rip, I know you...
Hello.
Hey, Rip, this is we're talking to Rip Rentz, and I know Rip as a man of letters, and in the classic sense of the word. Men of letters have largely disappeared because everybody now specializes in one particular genre of writing. But Rip does all of them. He's a journalist. He writes creative nonfiction. He has written novels, short stories, and poetry. And you have to go back to the 19th century to find writers like there were a few in the 20th century. Paul Goodman, for example, wrote social criticism. He wrote novels, short stories, poetry, a few plays even. So, but Rip is an all-round writer. And tell us a little bit about your background in writing, how you got started, and what drew you to being a writer.
Yeah, thanks for the kind words. I knew I was an anachronism, but I didn't realize it was so pronounced as, you know, there having been no one like me since the 19th century. So I'm delighted. Yeah, I'm a man of letters. Five, six, seven, eight letters make up my name. That's as far as I will legitimize that claim, but thank you. Yeah, I have written all these things that you've mentioned, you know, sort of jack of all trades, master of none, perhaps, but I am very dedicated to each mode and style. How did I get started? When I was in the second grade, we had to write an essay. If that's not too grand a term, you know, a couple of sentences. What we want to be when we grow up. So I went home and asked my dad what he did, and he said he was a publisher, which he had been briefly, but mostly he was a newspaper man. He was a journalist at the old Los Angeles Daily News, which had on its masthead the only Democratic newspaper west of the Rockies. And it was lonely here in newspaperdom, what with the arch-Republican L.A. Times and the Hearst Space. But in any case, that's where he worked. He was a sports writer. So I wrote this little essay that said, I'm going to be a publisher like my dad. And I never did become a publisher, but I did become a writer. And it just seemed like my natural proclivity you know, led me there. When I was in the fourth grade, I wrote a poem, which, if I can bring it to mind, was something like this. Rainy days, when skies are filled with gloom. Rainy days, when trees nor flowers bloom. People hope that on the morrow it will be gay and pleasant, not full of sorrow. But for the hope of the people, it is to be forsaken, for the rain remains and the day is taken. Now, that's fourth grade, so I was failing math and penmanship and everything else. So there's your eccentric answer, Richard.
Well, it's not bad for fourth grade.
I haven't done much that good since.
Well, no, please. But, you know, of all of the paths open to writing, you chose journalism initially.
Yes. In retrospect, it might have been a mistake, but it just seemed that it was the only thing I was fit for, was to major in journalism or be in journalism. At Venice High, I was on the school paper for 3 years, and the college paper at CSUN, and it just came naturally to me, you know, something I wanted to do. And when I say perhaps in retrospect, it might not have been the best way to go. I I just, you know, we all have regrets. Well, maybe you don't, but I do. And I always wished I had majored in, you know, several languages. But I didn't. And I wound up a copy boy, one of the last people probably hired to be a copy boy anywhere, at the old Valley News and Green Sheet in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah,
the newspaper that had the most... I'm sorry?
I had a friend that worked there at one point.
What was his name?
Jerry Scarpita. And it was in the 70s. I can't remember what period in the 1970s, but it was in the 1970s.
The name is vaguely familiar. Yeah, as we know, the paper, you know, it was renowned for having more tire tracks than any other newspaper in Southern California, meaning it just remained in driveways forever. It was a freebie. However, the Chicago Tribune bought it, took it over, turned it into a pretty nice newspaper while I was there. And there's a remarkable story, which it take too long to tell, but I wound up at the Herald Examiner working for a guy named Jim Bellows, who was one of the last, well, the name of his autobiography is The Last Editor. He was just one of the great newspaper editors of the 20th century, period. And I don't think anyone would argue that point. And I was enormously fortunate to work for him during the time I was there. And then I wound up freelancing, which, you know, as I've said too often, is a lot like writing for free. And finally, I reached a point where I didn't have to do that anymore. So I began writing books. And here we are.
Well, today when we hear about somebody who wants a career in journalism, they go to journalism school. And but you started... I mean, you started hands-on. You started as a copy boy, and you were already there. I mean, you didn't go to Columbia School of Journalism or something like that. It was like, again, it was the old-fashioned way. I know there's a filmmaker named Samuel Fuller who also started as a journalist in the same way, except he went on to make movies. And his movies have this sort of very graphic, vivid in-your-face type of filmmaking that is reminiscent of the period of journalism that he was involved with, which was just prior to World War II. And we know that businesses, professions change over time. And when you entered journalism, what was it, the 1970s?
Right. When I was hired on the newspaper, it was 73, I guess.
So you saw probably the last great phase of journalism before the digital revolution sort of reconfigured it in ways that are perhaps, my own view is that we are missing because of this. We are missing out because of the digital revolution and its effect on newspaper journalism, I think.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. You know, you mentioned Fuller, and he experienced newspapers when they were at their peak in terms of. Being wild and woolly, you know, the whole stereotype of the crazy newsroom and the guys with the visors and the half-chewed cigars yelling, copy, and all that stuff. So he really lived it. And that comes through, you're right, that does come through in his movies. There's a kind of a, you know, wild and woolly in-your-face quality to them and a realism.
Exactly.
And when I got into newspapers, I can't say they were still like that, but when I started at the Valley News, it was all linotype machines. It was hot lead. There were pneumatic tubes, mechanical typewriters. So really nothing had changed technology-wise since the 40s. And I watched all that die. I watched, you know, the linotype machines being hauled away and replaced by cold type, and I watched the typewriters come out, replaced by IBM Selectrics, and then they were replaced by computers, et cetera. So it was, I didn't realize I was witnessing history exactly, or I might have, maybe the thought entered my head, but I just thought it was, you know, transition, new technology, everything changes. But it really was a passing of traditional newspapers. Curiously, when I was hired at the Herald Examiner, the Valley News had completely turned in, gone modern. It was 100% computerized, and the Herald had not changed since the 40s. The desks, the typewriters, and I mean, once again, Olympic and Royal giant mechanical typewriters that once in a while were picked up and thrown against the wall by angry reporters. The place was a chaos. It was you know, the Venetian blinds were broken down. When I first walked in there to be interviewed, I took one look at the city room and I swore I would never work in that place. People screaming, smoking, eating, hollering, running. I mean, it made front page, you know, the various film versions of it, look tame. And as it turns out, you know, I worked there 5 years. It was the greatest experience of my journalism career because it was a real newspaper, and it was all because of Jim Bellows, who treated it like a real newspaper. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, comfort the afflicted. What is the expression? Afflict the comfortable, comfort the afflicted.
Yes, exactly. That's
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah. And that was what the Herald tried to do. I mean, we were what I think a newspaper ought to be. We were advocating for people who needed advocacy, you know, for people who were hurting, underdogs. And I was proud to be a part of that. But I've not seen that manifested in any other newspaper, certainly not to the extent it was at the Herald under Bellows. But I'm going on too long here.
No. That's all interesting stuff. I mean, it's, you know, I was going to say you were working in that classic Herald building downtown. Is correct? That the building is still
right,
there mercifully.
Right. Right. It's been turned into Arizona State University Journalism School. Go figure.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it was all dilapidated. It was this California Mission style building designed by Julia Morgan, who designed Hearst Castle, had a private apartment upstairs where the chief, William Randolph Hearst, you know, used to stay. It was full of roaches and I'm told rats. I saw a mouse or two. You know, it was what can you say? It was a very strange place to work, but it was a quite wonderful and magical place to work because every time you set foot into that lobby, that great garish, beautiful tile-laden classic lobby, which was like something out of Hearst Castle, you'd think of all the people, the thousands of people in the preceding 60, 70 years who had walked in there and spent the majority of their lives there. So there was a feeling of being part of a tradition, and that was wonderful. And I think all that's gone, Richard. I really do. Newspapers are not newspapers anymore. I mean, we all know what the Internet has done to them. They're all shrunk and skinny, and they have very few pages, and they're almost utterly preoccupied with surviving in the era of the Internet. And, you know, my opinion of the Internet and what it's done to journalism amounts to it has destroyed journalism. You know, yes, you can find great websites with great reporting, people who are really digging, coming up with the truth of the matter. But what's the fashionable term, balkanization? You know, the internet has, it's just one big balkanization. So what people tend to do, enlightened people and unenlightened people, is reinforce their belief systems, reinforce their prejudices. Any idiot, any martinet, any phony, any fraud can set up a website and give it the veneer and feel of something legitimate. And, you know, with, you know, and the, which leads ultimately to QAnon.
Yeah.
So there are any number of websites passing themselves off as legitimate news gathering and commentary. And they are anything but. They are agenda-driven creations of people with who have, you know, of megalomaniacs. And there is nothing amounting to traditional journalism or traditional vetting of fact, et cetera. And, you know, I'm sort of proselytizing here, but I'll cut it short. You know, that's. I think it's an absolute disaster what has happened, what the internet has done to journalism. And that's with the understanding that newspapers were severely flawed. But please go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say I do agree with that, and of course, yeah, the old hard copy print journalism, indeed, it was flawed, but it was not. It was not as flawed as the internet. Let's put it that way. I mean, there was no a thing like QAnon would be totally relegated to the margins. It would never occupy center space anywhere.
It wouldn't even get to the margins. It would stay in, you know, dive bars in Minnesota and couches with the stuffing coming out in Kentucky.
Excuse me. Yeah, I know. But anyway, we have looked on the dark side, so to speak. If we can, let's look on the bright side of your writing, which you've gone on.
You've written
two mystery novels. You have a sort of a quasi autobiographical novel, The Oaks. Two books of short stories, a book of poetry. And your latest book, which is Less Than Satisfying Encounters with Humanity, which are sort of true to life, or actually completely true, picaresque encounters with the unpleasant elements of humanity. It sort of reminds me, you know, there's this book by David Foster Wallace called Interviews with Hideous Men. So that's what I thought about when I heard the title of your collection. So tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, it's the second one, and it's just an anecdotal compilation of encounters with people that I find absolutely astonishing and indicative of how things have changed with the rise of the so-called millennial. And I don't mean anyone who happens to, you know, chronologically fit that description. I mean the stereotype, which is, I think, a valid stereotype. Let's see here. Here's one. I'll read you a fairly short one here. This is called High Cost of Rats. I was sitting, heavily sleep-deprived, in Little Tokyo, vaguely attempting to write with the aid of too much caffeine, but I was being bothered by Crocodile Dundee. Really, a guy in mysterious desert survivalist garb, head half-shaved, half-dreadlocked, buck knife the size of Utah, strapped to his waist. Hang on. And walking staff. Yes, a walking staff in downtown L.A. He was about 6'5". Oh, yeah, and a giant reptile on a leash. It's a baby dragon, he said over and over and over and over to passersby in a voice quite at odds with his physique. shrill, evocative of Jerry Lewis, and he was about 10 feet away from me. What? I'm making this up? Allow me to resort to a cliche. You can't make this stuff up. Of course, all the tourists and passers-by stopped to gasp and ask questions about the reptile, beginning with, of course, what is that? Turns out he wasn't just joking about it being a dragon. It was a baby Komodo dragon, the world's largest lizard, next to Keith Richards, a native of the Indonesian islands of Komodo, Rinca, Flores, and Gili Motang, a monster that boasts a powerful, tenacious bite accompanied by the secretion of toxic proteins from two glands in the lower jaw. You know, like Lady Gaga. This noble beast generally feeds on deer, but has been known to lower itself to eat humans as well. So what in the Paul Hogan was it doing on a leash in Little Tokyo? Funny, I had the same question. I involuntarily pulled my feet under the table.
His mother is at home,
said Dundee as Jerry Lewis, over and over and over and over, to each person who made an inquiry.
And she's a lot bigger.
Timid Japanese tourists bent down to pet the goddamn lizard, I swear, while the joker said,
he's trained, he won't bite,
over and over and over, seated at a table supposedly reserved for restaurant patrons. It was to the great luck of the tourist that, at least in this instance, he was correct. Now, understand, if you will, that I dislike reptiles, and I dislike people with no regard for those around them. I would, in a pinch, prefer a reptile. So I got up and moved elsewhere, but not before I heard Dundee complain about, I do not jest, the high cost of live rats, $5 each, which he feeds to his little pet. Yes, sirree, the quotidian problems of the average person. Honey, have you seen how much rats cost these days? What are we going to feed Hercules here, cornflakes? At my new table, more reptiles approached, specifically a young couple that parked next to me perpendicularly instead of sitting parallel. In other words, looking at me. The irrelevant old man show? They proceeded to take out grease-soaked bags of very smelly burgers and fries not purchased from the cafe hosting the tables and began wolfing them down in big slobbering bites. Feeding time! Eventually, they finished, licking their fingers, and the girl, about 18 and in the proverbial bloom of youth, let out a mighty, resonant, percussive belch. I mean a LeBron James-sized eruption. I was startled by the explosion, which was aimed directly at me, so I immediately saluted her, declaring, I salute you! She looked at me as if a building had come to life and spoken Chinese. Then she burst into laughter and said, sorry. I nodded in appreciation of her great courtesy. Next, oh, well, next, a young African-American man from Skid Row arrived, yelling at various strangers, fuck you, bitch, I don't got to take your shit, and other peaceable sentiments, followed by a horde of young skateboarders who very closely resembled the half-beast, half-men of Island of Lost Souls. Over the Little Tokyo Plaza bricks, they clattered, looking belligerently all around. I sipped some more caffeine. Overall, I concluded the lizard came off best. No pretense of being anything other than a cold-blooded killing and eating machine, unlike humans who pretend otherwise. Thank you very much.
That's good. But so, you know,
anyway,
and it's true.
I mean,
it's
if you live
true.
In L.A. and you go out in L.A., this stuff happens all the time.
I mean, I used to only see this sort of thing when I lived in New York City on the subway, the occasional madman that you would encounter on the subway. But it's definitely proliferated in recent years. I mean, it's certainly on the streets here in Los Angeles. Even. Yes, I've had similar encounters. So listeners
right.
who do not live in Los Angeles, yes, you can come here and you can have a good time and not spend a dime at Disneyland and see attractions that will astound the folks back home. So, and I was just one of them. So that's a terrific one, Riff. That's really
oh good.
Yeah, that's
yeah. Well, you're right. You know, I mean, yeah, you can experience things that will astound the folks back home. If you make it back home.
Well, you've also written period mystery novels. And before the show started, we were talking about the Bronzeville Boogie, which is, we were talking about the background of Bronzeville and explaining it to Raphael. And so for non-Angelinos or Angelinos who are of later generations, Bronzeville was a sort of an interregnum in the history of Little Tokyo. And it happened between the internment of the Japanese Americans in 1942 in the autumn of, pardon me, in the spring of 1942 and their return near the middle of 1945. And during that interregnum, African Americans moved in, occupied the vacant businesses and houses, and created their own community. So tell us about the Bronzeville Boogie. What is in outline? What is that about?
It concerns a Hapa detective that would be half Japanese American and half Caucasian by ancestry, whose name is Ed Funderburk, who's referred to by most people as Ed Thunderbird. And, you know, he's sort of he's an L.A. guy. He's been here forever, lives alone. You know, if I said he was not in the vein of Marlowe and Chandler's settings of L.A., I would be lying. Well, the core of the mystery turns out to involve Bronzeville. And it's this kind of Byzantine DNA twine that Funderburk investigates that takes him way back in his research to the beginnings of Bronzeville. And it involves a grudge, kind of a family grudge that has been passed down generation to generation. You know, I wrote it to a great extent because Bronzeville is forgotten, largely forgotten, largely unknown. It was this astonishing little freaky thing in the history of L.A. where Little Tokyo was emptied out of all of the Issei and Nisei, the first and second generation of Japanese and Japanese Americans who were, as we all too well know, were incarcerated. And so here you had their former neighborhood when all their businesses essentially deserted, and African Americans moved in. I can't tell you the how and why of it off the top of my head. I would have to reacquaint myself with the history. But they moved in, took over the neighborhood. Jazz clubs popped up. It was a hot, jumping place. I believe the population was like three or four times what it had been when it was Japanese and Japanese American. So it was a lively affair for just a few years, and then when the camps emptied out, people came back and reclaimed their businesses, and there was very little mention or memory of so-called Bronzeville, as it came to be called by the people who lived there after that. And I wanted to bring out in the context of a mystery novel, you know, this bit of history. I had a few people read the book and say, well, that was really, really imaginative how you made all that up. You know, I mean, black people didn't really take over Little Tokyo. Well, of course they did. They thought I'd made it up. So, yeah, I mean, that's essentially it. It's the second of two mysteries, and they run together. The first one is called The Death Sisters, and I recommend them highly. Do we have time, or are we done?
No,
we got 5 minutes. I told the other guests we're going to have 5 minutes long.
All right. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Five more minutes. Let's hear.
Well, here's a little passage from it, if I may, and it doesn't directly relate to Bronzeville, but in any case, there is a kind of stillness, or was, about L.A. you had to be there in the 40s, 50s, 60s, even early 70s to understand it. Part of it was due to the population being less than half of what it is now, and part of it was due to the population being half as feral as it is now. But there was more. It wasn't just quiet, and it wasn't just less traffic. The smog had something to do with it, I swear. You stayed inside on smoggy days when the horizon, if not the entire sky, was the color of perfectly made toast. They told you to do so, the city, the county, TV, and radio news. Stay indoors, refrain from unnecessary activity. You might experience pain on breathing. And you did. The smog might have affected acoustics, for all I know, and all that particulate matter deflecting and muffling natural sound. I mean, you'd drive or walk down a street anywhere from Venice to the valley, and all you could hear would be the sound of your footsteps, or tires crunching gravel. Nothing else. Maybe a distant dog bark, a door slam, a kid yelling out, but that would be it. Of course, there were rubber tires. These were rubber tires I'm talking about, not the steel belts that create today's whoosh, guaranteed to leave you with Swedish hearing aids by 60. That crunch of gravel had been comforting, like the sprinklers. It would be noon. People would be cowering in their houses from the heat and smog watching soaps, but their sprinklers and rainbirds would be on, by God. Shh. Had to maintain that blunderbuss ubiquitous green yard carpet. And these would be the only sounds, and they reinforced the stillness. Once in a while, even now, you get an echo of it, almost a paralysis, a stasis. It can happen on three-day weekends when about 50% of locals leave town dutifully in search of vacation, or sometimes when that perfect toast layer of smog hangs on the horizon. Add an old L.A. neighborhood where the houses are still flat-roofed adobes, bungalows, craftsmen from the teens and 20s, and you can feel it. Languid days of the 50s and 60s that seemed as big as years, stillness that made you feel lonesome and somehow comforted. It came back to me as I parked on 12th Avenue in the old L.A. neighborhood of Lamert Park, and I'll stop there.
Wow, that's very vivid and evocative writing, Rick. I think we are out of time, but we have been talking.
No, we still got three
Rick
more
Brent.
Minutes.
We got three.
Do you want to talk a little bit about? If you want to talk a little bit about.
Well,
Scott.
Before we wrap it up, there is something that Rip, Raphael, and I all have in common, and that is a fellow by the name of Scott Wanberg. We all met him at different periods. Rip has known him the longest. Met him when they were both going to high school together. Raphael met him in 1989. I met him a few years later, although actually I read some of his poetry in the 1970s even in a student poetry magazine. So this is one of these, what did Kurt Vonnegut call it in one of his novels, a kvass, where there is three people who don't know each other find something in common, and this is Scott Wanberg. I mean, of course, I met Raphael later, and I met Rip later, but we all knew Scott Wanberg, although we were never all with Scott at the same time. Well, maybe Raphael and I were, and I think maybe we might have been too, but not all three of us were in the same room with Scott at the same time. So, and I know he was a great guy, and he touched us all, and Rip, I know you honored him with a poem, so maybe you could let us hear a couple of fragments from that.
I'd love to. Anything to honor Scott Wanberg, I absolutely adore the opportunity to do. Scott used to, as we all know here, he used to riff incessantly, and there were recurrent motifs that. You know, sometimes you wouldn't hear for a year or two, but they would come back. And one of them was Dr. Wickwire. Scott would just be referring to this Dr. Wickwire. Maybe it was a character from a book he read. I never knew. So this is a little bit of the poem. It's Dr. Wickwire come to save the world from demographics and marketing with his nuclear anti-id machine. It looks like a vacuum cleaner, and he looks like Captain Beefheart, but it's just a ruse. Will the people listen or brush him aside as another eccentric? Stay tuned for Chapter 13 of Dr. Wickwire versus the Greedball Murderers of Lions and Trees, Coming soon to an eyeball or unexploded minefield near you. Co-starring Rex the Wonder Horse and Tico Tico, cosmic dog of Nigu Vigu. Brought to you by Empathy, the beer that made Milwaukee famous. Dr. Wickwire, Dr. Wickwire, what do we do about hamburgers? There are 40 people in the world and 5 of them are hamburgers, said Wickwire. Huh? Who would have thought that fascism would come as a double cheese bacon burger? Wickwire laughed, took out the old 1950s Hoover-like thing and aimed at the television set and said, now, kiddies, I'm going to erase the ids of millions and replace them with brand spanking new ids. You know, he added, id is short for idiot. And with that, Wickwire aimed the device and blood shot out of the end of it. Well, it looked like blood, and it went right into the TV screen for 2 days and gradually filled it until you couldn't see TV. You couldn't see any more picture, only blood. There, said Wickwire, all done. Now to get over to Puffin Island and feed the chicks. Global warming has wiped out their herring diet, you know. I'll cut it off there. That's about it.
Well, that's about a third. That really brings Scott to life. Anybody that knew him will pick up on this exactly.
That
is great. Really great.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you. Well, I deliberately emulated him, so you know.
I know. You did it perfect.
A cheap imitation.
Perfect.
Yep.
Well, it was. Thank you, gentlemen.
It's a pleasure to be in this carass.
Yeah. Well, you call it a cheap imitation, but I find a lot of respect and appreciation and love for Scott in that. You know, because you know you have to get into him to be able to imitate him that well. But anyway, I guess now we really are out of time, and I want to thank you, Rip, for talking to us.
What a pleasure.
Yeah, well, you can order Rip's books at his website, The Rip Post. That's www.riprents.com. All of the books are there. He has blog entries, and if you've enjoyed sort of the vast range of his writing that we've only been able to sample here, we got some of his we got that beautiful passage from the Bronzeville Boogie. We got his poem. We had his terrific reminiscences of journalism. Do check out his website and buy his books. Support this guy. He's worth it. Thanks again, Rip.
I cannot convey my gratitude sufficiently to both of you. Thank you so much.
Sure. And now we have Jackie Voy Baynard. Howdy.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. I like the little nod to Texas there.
I always say howdy. I didn't even know. I never thought about that, but I say howdy a lot.
Do you? Yeah.
Thank you.
I was like, oh, the little nod to Texas to me. I appreciate it. Well, hello.
So to get this started, how long have you been running and when did you start?
I started running in eighth grade, so that was a very long time ago. I've got a 14-year-old now, so about that same age, middle school. I was in track, and I did the 440, I guess, the sprint. And I had a friend who said, you know what, I think you should try distance with me. And that's where it started.
Distance. Oh, I don't even want to think about distance right now, but how many marathons have you ran?
I've run two now. Yeah.
Okay.
20 years ago, I ran my first one. And 2 years later, I did another one. I got pregnant, had a baby, and, you know, things got in the way. But being part of the community online with runners my age and really feeling like I want to keep – well, I have MS, so I definitely want to keep that at bay. And so I was thinking, you know, I think in honor of that 20-year anniversary, I'm going to try to do another one in February.
So how does the MS affect your running?
Well, that was really the reason why I stopped. It's kind of crazy. I got sick in 95 and took about 5 years to get my bearings as far as what was going on, what the diagnosis was, what the treatments were, what my choices were. And to be quite honest, the treatments were far worse than the symptoms I was having. I found a neuropath who put me on, you know, some vitamins and some, oh gosh, just great advice about being healthy and stress release and yoga and different things like that. And one of the things that I remembered from growing up, the thing that released the stress the best was running. And I thought, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to run. And I started doing it. And I thought, you know, what better way to say up yours MS than to run a marathon?
Well, that's definitely one way to handle it. I mean, it definitely helps. I mean, how's your PR? Is it good, or are you just running to run and you don't care about the PR?
Yeah, no, I'm slow. Yeah, about five and a half hours. It's funny because I joined Austin Fit. You know, they have them all over the country to train together, and got to know some of the elites. And they have so much respect for the back of the packers because they just can't imagine. Why would anybody run for 5.5 hours? They're going to do a marathon, but they're going to get it done in 3.
Yep.
yeah. So I love that. Heck yeah. Well, I saw you were just getting better and better out there every day, a little bit better.
I'm kind of stubborn and stupid.
Why?
It's genetics. It's just, I call it stubborn because I keep going and it's like, well, I think you know about it. I mean, when you first start the marathon, you're like, why am I here? And then about 5-10 miles in, you feel comfortable. Then you know you're going to do it. But when you first begin, it's like, why am I up so early?
Right. What? Who thought of this? Well, I'll tell you, when I went hiking with my daughter and my husband, that was about a year and a half ago or so, maybe almost 2. And I really realized that my balance was off. My vertigo was crazy. I couldn't keep up with them. I couldn't climb like I used to. And, you know, because it starts to sap you of your strength. I said, forget this. And I went to the Y and I started at the YMCA every day at lunch. I couldn't even dress out. I just would take my tennis shoes, get on the treadmill, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Finally got up to where I was doing a mile. And I was like, okay, I don't like the treadmill. I'm going to get back outside. Well, I was falling. Oh my God. I've never fallen. Have you fallen yet?
Yeah, I've tripped and gone flying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the first time it happened, I knew there was a crack in the sidewalk. I was going to take some red paint and I was going to paint it so nobody could. Well, I went back over there. There was nothing. I just fell, you know. And bloodied up myself and pulled some ribs across, you know, away from the muscle and all of that. But, you know, I went back out there and did it again. And my husband, and I kept falling. I fell a couple more times. And my husband was getting real upset. You need to quit. And I was like, no, what I'm going to do, I know when I start to really kind of push myself to the next, because I was, you know, 1 mile, 2 miles, 3 miles, 4 miles. And I realized that every time it was the next step, that's when I fell because I was too tired. So I just told him, I said, no, you know what, I'm going to stay at a comfort zone a little bit longer before I go to the next level. And that seems to be working. I haven't, let me knock on some wood, I haven't fallen in a while yet, so I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I actually talked to a person who runs her own, you know, running series, because I told her I was doing 15 miles like for like 3 weeks straight, and she told me, maybe you should do 5 and then 10, then 5 and then 10, and it'll make you stronger. And she said, I'm probably like overdoing it, and she was probably right, and it's actually been helping. So I've learned to, what's that word, moderate and not push too hard, but still push.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, you got...
It's hard, right?
You know, when you're... Yeah, no, it's hard not to keep going because you want to keep going and you want to get past certain levels. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to end up injuring yourself and then you can't do it at all. Which,
sure,
you know.
Sure. And You know, yeah, and I've got this mentality of, you know, I don't want to cheat it. I don't want to cheat it. I could do that one more mile. Oh, I'm kind of tired. You know, I need to take, come on, don't cheat it. Just do it. I hate that feeling because I know it's wrong.
Yep. Well, it's like when you're like close to like, you know, you're 10 miles, but you're only 8, and you got to get to the 10 miles because you're not going to feel right. But then when you do 11 and 12, you want to get to 15, then you get mad at yourself because now you can't get to 15.
Right,
I do that
right.
A lot.
I think her, you know, it's so funny that you said that, you know, her technique was, you know, do 5, 10, 5, and 10, and it makes you stronger. That's exactly how I started out with a friend in eighth grade, Cynthia Baeta, and I'll never forget this girl. I can't do it. She, yeah, you can. You know, you walk to here and then you run to there. You walk to here and then you run to there. And tomorrow we're going to run, you know, and she just sort of broke it down for me. And, you know, that's sort of how I run today still. You know, oh, I'm going to run to that light pole and then I'll walk to the fire hydrant, whatever. But yeah, sometimes you got to step back.
All right. I've learned also how to, you know, I've learned one thing about running for me when I run a marathon or I do a 5K, that's when I'm going for more speed. But when I'm just doing maintenance, I just run to enjoy it, you know, just to enjoy the distance and not go crazy for a PR. I mean, I do speed runs where I am trying to beat my run, but I do this 5 miles to me on my speed runs where I'm trying to get to 5 miles in 35 minutes and I'm kind of stuck at 37. But the thing is, 37 is pretty good, so I shouldn't beat myself up, you know?
Right.
You know, especially for an old man. I'm 56.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. See, the age thing. You know, I really beat myself up about a lot of it. And, you know, wait a minute. You're not 25, you're 55.
Yeah.
Knock it off.
We got to take, you know, consider our age, you know?
For sure.
If we're... You know, the thing is, I interviewed a 75-year-old who told me he finished the marathon in 5 hours. I'm like, fuck, I want to be 75 and finish a marathon in 5 hours.
Wow.
You know,
no kidding.
You know,
that's fantastic.
And he did three in a row. And he's like,
oh, my
you know,
God.
He goes,
well,
sometimes
I
have to walk. I'm like, yeah, I can't really give you any complaints. You're 75 and you're still doing marathons. I can't really knock it.
No way. Well, I just saw that endurance runner. I think he was like 75. I don't know if you saw the video and the bless his heart. I mean, he was hunched over and kind of, and all of his friends, Bob. I'm like, good for you, Bob. And he crossed the finish line. And once he crossed the finish line and got his beer, you know, he's smiling and he's fine. I was like, okay, you and I, kindred spirits, buddy.
Yep. No, I agree. I mean, the funny thing about the 75-year-old, I told you, like, he actually had a mild heart attack during the marathon, and he found out after he finished. And then they told him to stop running for about 2 or 3 weeks. But he didn't know he felt a little pain in his heart, but he didn't think it was anything, so he kept running. But it was a mild heart attack. So I'm like, damn.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a little scary right there. Well, you know, I kind of allude to the fact that I didn't grow up in the best household. And growing up, I always had this like heart problem. My mom, honey, everybody has it. It's just palpitations. Okay. And I remember there was one particular day I was out on the trail. It was probably 80, 90 degrees. It was hot and I was running and it happened. And I was thinking to myself, okay, this is just palpitations. I probably just wait it out or look around. Maybe I should find some. Well, anyway, I got past it. Well, fast forward about 15 years, and it's still happening. I went to the doctor, and I actually had a heart problem. He's like, oh, my God, you could have stroked out any of these times. It's like,
wow.
Oh, crap. See, that's when your mentality, I'm fine. That's a runner thing, too. I know it from all my friends that are runners.
It's a runner thing. No, we don't stop and we don't think about it. We do so many crazy things. I didn't even know. I thought it was only me. I have 16 pairs of shoes. I found out somebody that buys at the same place has got 50 pairs. I'm like, okay, I'm not that bad. You know, runners run
awesome.
With toilet paper just in case. I thought that wasn't normal, but I, you know, a lot of other runners run with toilet paper just in case.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I didn't take that into consideration until I started, you know, becoming more acquainted with the community. You know,
right.
And
I love the community.
Me too. I mean, they're very supportive. You know, they like it when you want to, they like the fact that I want to, you know, push, you know, runners in interviews, even, you know, even beginners, because even beginners have a story, you know?
Right.
You know, it's a conversation. I mean, I really respect the fact that you, with MS, are still running. I mean, a lot of people would just, you know, be home thinking of other ways to take care of themselves and not trying to run. You know?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny you say that because I belong to two MS groups. One, they're on the meds, which is, this is just an example, you know, no judgment, whatever. But there's one that they're all on the meds. And there's another group that we MS naturally. And there's a big difference in the mindset
mm-hmm.
on both sides. And very much of what you said. And when I was really, really sick, when I first got diagnosed and I was sick, I was blind. I was sick. And I thought, you know, my husband, he's like, you've been on the couch for like a month. What are you going to do? And I was like, I'm just so sick, you know? And he's like, all right, well, you know, I don't even remember the conversation now, so many years ago, but it didn't go well. And I remember I got up that day, the next day, and I got down the stairs, and we lived in an apartment. That was all I could do. I was like, well, let's see what happens tomorrow. The next day, I got down a little bit further. The third day, I'm going to write a book one day. I got to the dumpster. The day I got to the dumpster, and as soon as I got to the dumpster, I knew. And then, like, I don't know how long it was after that, maybe 3 weeks, there was a trail. And I used to run the loop. There's a loop. I used to always run mm-hmm. it before I got sick. And I was like, I'm going to get to the loop. I'm going to do the loop today. Well, I got halfway, and there was a payphone. I couldn't do the rest, but I called my husband. I said, come get me. But, you know, I was on the trail. I did half of it. So I knew. And how can you not do that?
No,
you know, just
no.
keep pushing.
Well, no, some people, you know, I mean, I've seen the effects of medication, and I really don't like them. I like your idea better because, I mean, you know, you're still doing it. And when you're on medication, I've seen people heavily medicated where they can't, you know, they're zombied out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're not even aware.
It's difficult. It's,
you know.
Yeah. I weighed the options for sure. But, you know, when the side effects are, you know, death or, you know, cirrhosis of the liver, whatever, all these crazy things. I'm like, well, I don't have any of that now. Why would I? Why do I add to what I've
no,
got
going
on?
No, I love
on?
That, you know. No, I love commercials. It may cause anal breathing. It may cause this. And it's like, and you want me to take this? Like,
yeah.
Ask your doctor.
Yeah,
who will
it
recommend
was...
it. You know, it's like,
oh,
no,
yeah.
But, you know, the side effects are worse sometimes than, you know, it's like chemotherapy, what it does to people. It might cure the cancer, but partially, you know, it destroys you inside.
Sure.
You know, so it's like,
absolutely.
So what are your long-range goals if you're running right now?
Yeah, well, right now I'm feeling so good. I wanted to get up to 5 miles, and I'm almost there. Did
yeah,
4 miles yesterday morning, and I felt great. Yeah, yeah. And I want to get, you know, I'm running about 3 days a week, but I want to get up to, you know, 4 or 5. And then for sure, there's the Boston Marathon is in February, and that's the one that I've done before. And I was talking to a girlfriend at work who is a runner. She's much younger.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably 30 years younger than me. But I'm trying to get her to get excited and do it because I'm thinking I need a long runner partner for
Pacer.
Like the Saturday long runs or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's my long-term goal.
No, I mean, that's a great goal. I mean, right now, I got a 31-mile race coming up Saturday, and it's all in the hills and trails, and I'm like, what was I thinking when I signed up for this?
Holy cow. Wow.
Yeah,
well,
it makes it worse.
I love trail. Yeah.
It makes it really worse, and my little son goes to me, I know you can do it, Dad. I'm like, ah, crap, now I got the kid guilt.
No doubt.
It's like, oh, no, I got the kid pressure. Oh, man, I got to do it now. So, you know,
oh, I love
now
that.
I have to
I've
finish.
Got my kid pressure. Yeah, you got to do it now.
Well, yeah.
But it's sweet.
Like you
You'll have
the hat
that in your
wear.
Face. You're... Aw.
Yeah.
You're going to have that in your mind when you're running. That's going
to
motivate you.
No, it's like, and go, Max, which one do you want me to wear? Do you want me to wear Maximo's Ultra Marathon Dad, or do you want me to wear the hospital you were born in? And he goes, hospital. I'm like, okay, that's the hat I'm wearing. So I always tell him, I always ask him which hat to pick, and I tend to wear what color shirt he likes. So usually, if it's green, I'll wear green, or his favorite superhero or something like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah,
well, no, it's always great when you have your
kid. Cheerleader for sure. Yeah.
No, it's great
Does
when your kids are
you?
Bragging to their
Does
school
he like
friends.
It?
Huh?
Oh, yeah. Does he run? Does he run with you?
No, he wants to. He wants to start, and it's funny. He, like, brags to his kids, my daddy's stronger than yours, and they go, what do you mean? My daddy can run 26 miles. What can your daddy do? And it's like, my ex-wife has been telling me he's been bragging. It's like, all the kids get quiet when he mentions the miles.
Oh, sure.
So
heck,
nice.
Yeah. I
mean,
nice. Especially, you know, certain age, there's no running happening anymore. It's only the crazy ones who keep going.
Yeah, no, basically, no. I mean, when you run, you get meditative. I mean, I get really zen-like when I run, when the endorphins kick in and I just go, and it's just, I don't know. Sometimes I don't even remember where I'm running. I just remember I enjoyed it. You know, it's kind of funny that way running works.
Yeah, no, I'm not there. When I'm running, I'm not in my body. I'm in my mind, basically.
Yep.
I don't even notice it. Yeah, and, you know, it saved me in another way. I was in a pretty tough spot where I was working, and I wasn't happy. I was not happy at all, and I had decided the year of 2020, of all years, of course, 2020 was going to be the one where, you know, I'm going to do all the scary things. I'm going to do all the tough things. I'm going to do everything, all the yeses. So it started out, we do a polar bear jump into Barton Springs. It's 60-degree water and spring fed. It's beautiful in the summer. January 1, no cold. But my daughter and I, we just decided we're going to do this. We're going to just do something scary. So we did that. And then I got invited to be a keynote speaker at a women's conference. And I was so nervous about that. I'll do it. I did that. And I said, okay, well, these things are changing. And then everything changed. Everything changed. I started getting job offers, and I got another great new job, and everything just changed. And I think that's what you were saying about being meditative and open. And that's what I was doing when I was running, just opening my heart.
No, it's your mindset. Yeah. I think the running changes your mindset. It makes you, it's like somebody, I think somebody wrote that, you know, for, you know, running even 5 miles, 2 miles, it helps the people who are depressed not be depressed. It helps them get out of depression.
Yeah.
And I, when I'm having a bad day, I really want to, you know, I feel a funk when I run, it gets rid of the funk because, you know, I'm accomplishing something. I'm not sitting still. And I always find interesting places to run, you know, places like, you know, I find hills and I like the views that I find, or I run by the beach, you know, because running actually saves me. It keeps me balanced, you know.
For sure. I wish I had because when I was growing up, I was in Corpus Christi, and it's not a beautiful place, but I ran down by the water, you know, and being by the ocean and or the Gulf, and it's just that changes your mindset. Watching the sunrise and being part of that, or running down. Oh, I missed the beach. Running on the beach, that was the best.
No, the beach is great. I'm
talk about
I run towards Pacific Coast Highway, and I like watching the sunrise when I, you know, when during COVID, I couldn't go to the gym, so I ran more. So I had more time. And the funny thing is, muscles made me heavy, so I actually ran better when I wasn't, you know, when my body wasn't complete. When my body wasn't in shape and I was just a runner, I ran more. I mean, ran faster. But I don't want to give up the strength, so it's kind of like, now I have to deal with the fact I'm probably not running as fast as I did without the muscles.
Right, so right. Kind of like, as a trade-off, for sure.
Yep.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm, you know, a mom, and my daughter's real, you know, loves squishing on me and stuff. And since I've been running, I've been getting, you know, fit. And she's like, I miss your body, Mama. Oh. But, you know, how do you explain? And I don't want to talk about body stuff with her. You know, she's 14, middle, starting high school. But, you know, I told her, I said, you've got a beautiful athletic body. And she's like, oh, I want a body like yours, Mom. Like, oh, that's so sweet.
That's cool. You're inspiring her. I mean, the thing is, she said it on her own. And I hate parents to push their kids to do something. She's actually inspired by your example, which is better than, you know, you telling her, hey, why don't you do something? That's a lot better.
Right.
That's sweet, actually. Yeah. I mean, that's when your kids actually notice that you're taking care of yourself and they're actually inspired by you. And that's beautiful, you know.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not an easy job, is it, being a parent, but it's the best job.
No, it's not, but the thing is when your kids notice that you're, you know, that you're different than the other parents, you know, you do more than the other parents, and you're, you know, you take care of yourself, and then in some ways it makes them want to take care of themselves too. So it's a great example for your kids. You know, and your daughter probably knows about the MS. She probably knows your MS struggling. She's probably really... You know, like, wow, Mom does that with all the other shit that she goes through, you know?
Yeah. So she's very supportive of that, for sure.
No, kids love when their parents are tough, and they don't say anything. Even when they're mad at them, they're like, damn, my mom's cool. You know, I mean, for all the fights that I got with my dad, I've always respected that he was very intentionally loyal to his kids. He wouldn't let anybody talk bad about us, even if he was mad at us. You know,
Papa Bear.
That meant a lot to me. Well, yeah, it's like my dad would want to kill me, but if anybody said a bad word about me, he'd probably knock him on their ass. That's my kid.
Exactly.
It's like, I'm allowed to say stuff, but you're not, you know. But, you know, I understand. It's like,
for sure.
You know, that. I mean, all my brothers think I'm crazy because I run so much, but they respect it, but they still think I'm crazy. You know.
And there you
but
go.
They're supportive.
That's the...
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, I'm really impressed, you know, because I mean, people who go through what you go through sometimes do the medicated way, and you know, the medicated way doesn't always lead to anything good. You know, I mean, it's great for some people, but I think what you're doing is better for you.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm just so encouraged right now, and I really do want to do that marathon. And I you know, I post on both those MS sites, but I try on the one that's a little less positive to, you know, to put my struggles down there. And I remember, I guess I ran 4 miles the first time, and I posted, and somebody's like, well, at least you can run 4 miles. And I was like, look, it doesn't come easy. Let's not tear each other down.
That's bitterness. That's just bitterness because they're not trying and they can't. And you have to take it for what it is. You know, that's their response to their own failings. I mean, somebody told somebody that I care about, I'm close to, that they don't like me because I post too much about being healthy. And she told me he's basically overweight, and I'm like, well, there it is. He's not happy because he can't do what I do. And I can't be mad at him for that because he's already angry at himself, you know?
Exactly, exactly.
So what's the point of me going to him and getting in trouble, you know? Yeah.
No, you keep doing you, but that's the thing, you know, everybody's different, right? Like with this MS, you know, some people do get very, very, very ill, way, way more ill. But then I wonder, could I have been, I think I could have been that ill. I think I could have,
thing, I mean,
I,
Yep. But you took steps not to be that ill.
Yep. Right.
Plus, yeah. I mean, the thing is, when you post something positive, you know, not everybody's going to react like the person that's negative. They might actually get inspired not to just be medicated and get inspired to actually maybe do something that they like to make themselves happy. So
right.
I think it's
right.
cool
and
that
when
you,
I do...
you, know, you post, yeah, it helps them.
Yeah,
you know,
when somebody does say
shell.
Something. Yeah, yeah. And when when I do feel like there's interest, I'm like, hey, man, you know, this isn't the only MS support group. There's another one over here
yeah.
that they yep. don't, they're not on the drugs. Check it out. See what you
yeah.
want to see and open yourself up to what. That's part of why I'm doing this with you today. You know, open yourself up. You never know what you're going to hear or learn or see or change.
Well, the thing is, some medication is definitely needed, but it's like at the same time, you can't let it, you know, take over. You know, it's like this is the only way I'm going to get better, but there's other ways, you know. And
right.
what you're doing, I think, is
absolutely.
The best way for you because, I mean, it's got your mindset. Like you said, everything started falling into place, you know. And it might
yeah.
not have fallen into place if you're just medicated, you know.
Yeah.
Because as
yeah,
good
it
as
changes everything.
Off, sometimes, I think sometimes medication takes some of your drive away, too. You know, your push. And it goes away because,
mm-hmm.
and then you lose it, then you don't focus. I mean, yeah, to have something like what you have and to actually accomplish running all the time and then get past, you know, I mean, a lot of people, once they fall one time, they're like, nope, I'm done. But, you know, you fell a couple times and, you know, and you keep getting up. And the woman I used to take care of who passed, she had vertigo. So I know vertigo is a bad thing. I've seen it in front of me. I've seen her vertigo hit her and it's like, I have to walk her back to her bed because she couldn't, you know, she couldn't make it out because if the vertigo was so bad. So, I mean, you're running with that and the possibility of vertigo hitting you. That is freaking, you know, in some ways courageous because, damn, you know, a payphone might not be nearby, you know, and you might not be able to, you know. So that takes, you know, that's in a way gutsy, you know, to keep going.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm just,
you push.
I was running. Yeah, there was one day that my husband was out of town and I was running. I was probably dumb to go while he was not in town. But yeah, it was early, 6 o'clock in the morning or something. The streets were deserted except for one car kind of driving by and I took just this tumble. And they looked at me and I looked at them and I just got up and I guess they noticed I was okay and they drove away. But I was just, that just made me think of that, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to keep going. You know, there was no payphone. There was nothing. I was like, all right,
yep,
am I going to limp home or am I going to run home?
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah.
That's the way I always think about when I fall down, am I going to walk it off or am I going to just keep running? I just keep running. You know, I get up.
But you still got to get home one way or the other, right?
Well, no, I mean, the thing is,
I want to
like
get home fast.
When you trip and you realize it's still 7 miles away, it's like, oh, crap, I got to keep running. Yeah, because I ain't going to walk the seven miles. You know, and it's like...
No
the
way.
Funny thing about LA, and this is really good, struck me, when I took a trip down somewhere in Hollywood, the person in a nice suit walked by and left me on the floor. The homeless guy actually picked me up and offered me water.
Oh,
so
I'm sure.
That told me a little bit about people. This guy who could help me, no, but the homeless guy who has nothing picks me up and offers me water.
Yeah.
So, you know, it shows you who people are. You know, when you're running, you learn a lot about people, too, and the way they... Some people cheer you on. Some people, like, are impressed that you're running. Some people, like, you know, go, good job. And it's like, that's always nice when you're running. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, your whole thing is pretty impressive. I mean, the fact that, you know, I mean, just to go through that and then to go through all that pain and then to, you know, bounce back. A lot of people don't bounce back, you know?
Well, you know, some of it's my childhood, too, right? You know, it was pretty pretty crappy, you know, growing up and running to escape. And I would just run.
Yep.
I mean, 12 miles. I just ran until I thought the coast was clear that I could come home. So, you know, that's deeply, deeply embedded in me.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I mean, my childhood wasn't that crappy, but I was running from other things, you know, I mean. But, I mean, anytime I broke up, you know, when I broke up with somebody I really cared about, I ended up running a bunch of miles.
And it's just to
get over it, you know, and that it was either that or I had quit drinking. So it was either go back to drinking or run. So I chose running, you know, and it's kind of like,
sure.
You know, but it's really,
you have to be careful because that can become just as much of an addiction too, right?
Oh no, I'm addicted. I know it. I'm fine with it.
Well, the shoes gave it away.
Yeah, no, it's like I just got a Camelback, which I already tried out, which I love now. It's like, yeah, you know what? I might just use the Camelback when I do 10-mile runs because it's a lot easier than, you know, a bottle. I could just put the straw in my mouth and, you know, slurp. So I kind of like that. It's kind of like, this is kind of handy. Why didn't I do this before?
That's so funny you said this. We've got Camelbacks, and I was thinking about pulling them out. So you enjoy running with it?
Well, I need it for the 31-mile run, so I was testing it because it's brand new, and it actually, I got the rice, it fits perfect, and I'm probably going to write a review, talk about it on the show eventually, but the thing is, it was comfortable. I can put about 2 liters because I needed 2 liters for the 31-mile run, and the straw,
yeah.
You know, I adjust the straw, and you just have it there handy for your mouth, and I'm going to have, like, I was wrecked. Someone told me I need at least 7 gels for the whole run, so I'm going to have gels and I'm just going to be super cautious because now that I have the kid pressure, I have to finish.
Right, right.
You know?
Well, you know something that I've discovered that's been helping me with my MS because of the heat? You know, I'm sure you've seen a little bit about what's going on in Texas. Like, it's ridiculous,
mm-hmm.
100-plus degrees, all this. And I had heat stroke in the spring. We were at a festival. And I just, all of a sudden, I told my husband, I said, call 911. And he was like, what? And I passed out, this huge festival. My daughter's freaking out. Everybody's freaking out. It turns out that, you know, they iced me down and all of this. And I was okay. But they were like, and my husband said, it's her MS. The heat just, it's too much for MS. But anyway, those cooling towels, I keep one in the freezer and I cold, you know, before I run. And then it stays cold the whole time I'm running. They're fantastic.
Wow, that's an idea.
They're life-saving.
Yeah, yeah.
You just put them in a baggie with some ice, and they stay. And once you pull it out, and they're quote-unquote dry because they're not dripping, but they're cool.
Yeah.
You put them on your neck, on your face.
That's got to feel nice. I know, like when I ran through sprinklers when it's really hot, it feels good.
Yep.
Yeah, no.
Yep.
So when's Boston coming?
So
February?
The Austin one is February 24th, I think.
All right. Well, we're going to have to interview you again. I mean, even if you don't do it, just to see your progress.
Yeah, that'd
you know,
be
I
awesome.
Mean,
I'd be down.
No, the thing is, I try to – everybody who's – I mean, I've actually – most people that I've interviewed have actually been pretty interesting. This is kind of embarrassing. I had a 13-year-old kid who's already ran a 50-mile run with his dad, and I'm like – oh, man, kid, you're making me feel weak. But, yeah, you did 50 miles. Yeah.
Wow. No, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
That kid can do it. I can do it. You're going to be great.
Well, I mean,
you're going to do great. You've got the base.
Yeah, no, it's just it's the push. I mean, but no, there's always – I mean, I tell everybody it's healthy to have doubt. If you don't have too much doubt and you're too cocky, I think cockiness makes you feel more than doubt.
Yeah, for
you know,
sure. I agree.
You don't want to be in the line, I'm going to kill this. I'm going to kill this. And then the line, you know, 22 miles is like, I can't do it anymore. What was I thinking? You know?
I don't want to be over cocky.
I just want to enjoy it.
When your mind, that's mind over matter at that point. Your body, you're ready. You got it. But you just got to keep telling yourself you got it in your head.
The main thing in my thing is Max. I can't tell Max I didn't finish, so it's like that's what the whole run's gonna be like. When I'm really tired, it's like so I gotta call my keep going. It's like that's what's gonna happen when I think about stopping. I gotta call the kid and say I didn't finish. Fuck.
Yeah.
Maybe I could lie. No, I can't lie to the kid. Can't start that.
No, I can't lie.
You know, there's few people that you're okay with lying to, like when you go to confession. You don't tell the whole truth. You just tell them some of this good stuff that they want to hear because it's like, no, not going to tell them that. But the thing is, you know, you don't lie to your kids, you know, because you don't want them – you always want them to trust you.
Yep.
So, you know,
I agree
100%. No, but it's been great talking to you. I mean, and it's very, you know, I think it's encouraging for other runners to know that, you know, that you actually keep going with what you're going through, that, you know, it's amazing, you know, what the mind can do, even, you know, when the body is like, nope, don't want to do it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that really helped me was joining that Runners Over 50 and realizing one of the very first posts I saw was a woman who had fallen. She didn't have MS.
Yep.
She just fell. I'm like, oh, screw
yep.
that. If everybody's fallen, I'm just going to fall like everybody else. I want to be part of the cool group.
No,
well,
one time
thank you for having
car...
me. I appreciate that.
No, I would love to have you. I mean, in February, I want to have you again. You know, I definitely want to have you again, and I'll probably say hi once in a while, you know, and send you the newer posts if you want them, you know, and just, because, I mean, I'm definitely going to send
yeah,
you the
absolutely.
Shows once we're done, you know, and then, you know, you could either tell me you hated the show or you didn't like the show, and like, maybe you should have asked this question, you know, I don't mind, but no, I mean,
okay.
No, it was great having you, and it's pretty inspiring, because, I mean, I've had one show where a woman has, strides where it's people sober and recovery running, you know, where the whole thing is,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
running. So I like having, you know, people who actually, you know, I don't mind just straight runners, but your backstory is great because for some people who are actually going through illness, it shows them that you can get past it, you know?
Right.
You
right.
know, there's other ways
yeah,
to heal.
That's for sure. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to share my story. Absolutely. Get that out there. And if,
yeah.
even if it's just one person who's kind of struggling, you know.
Yep. Yep. No, it's great having you.
Well,
we've been
yeah,
talking
we'll stay
to
connected
Jackie
and...
Voy, Bernard. I think I said it wrong the first time. Damn.
No, I think
it's
my
you.
Husband's last name. So
that's okay then.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
It was great having you, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again when you finish the Boston Marathon, because I think you will. Because, you know.
I will let you know, for sure.
Well,
have a great afternoon.
I think you have it in you. You too. Take care. This has been another
Poet
Runner podcast. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being on the show. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.